Translation. Every day, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to see the Upala Bhoga ceremony at the temple of Jagannath. And after seeing this, he used to go visit these three great personalities on his way to his own residence. Purport. Upala Bhoga is a particular type of offering performed just behind the Garuda Stambha on a stone slab. That stone slab is called the Upala. All food is offered within the temple room just below the altar of Jagannath. This bhoga, however, was offered on the stone slab within the vision of the public. Therefore, it is called Upala Bhoga. So basically, the bhoga then is always offered in the deity room, right, in front of the deities. But in this offering, then here's Prabhupada pointing out that it's offered in front of the public so that people could see what the offering is. Right? It's just like we have festivals, then many times we'll do the offering and people can see what is the offering. Right? You might put up a cloth or something simple, but basically everyone can see what's the size, the variety, or everything like that. So it inspires, you know, kind of like an appreciation of what's going on. Otherwise, so many offerings may be there, but since no one can see them, then no one really knows what's going on. But here, then, this one offering then is done so people can see, like that. Any questions on that? Etim madhye jape take e jana Tare ashi apane mile prabhura niyama. If one of these three was not present, he would meet the others. That was his regular practice. Deve ashi prabhu jabe udvete cha hila chale gonja tale patre se shloka paila. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to the residence of Srila Rupa Goswami, he accidentally saw the palm leaf on the roof, and thus he read the verse composed by him. Shloka padi ache prabhu avishta haiya Rupa Gosai ashi pade dandavat haiya. After reading the verse, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went into an ecstatic mood. While he was in that state, Srila Rupa Goswami came and immediately fell down on the floor like a rod. The word danda means rod or pole. A rod or pole falls straight. Similarly, when one offers obeisances to a superior with all eight angas, parts of its body, he performs what is called dandavat. Sometimes they only speak of dandavats, but actually do not fall down. In any case, dandavat means falling down like a rod before one's superior. So dandavat is one of the two kinds of, you have panchanga, which means that the two knees, the two arms, and the head is touching the ground, right? So this is where we're, you know, bending the knees. Dandavat means then eight parts, the 2 feet, the two knees, 2 feet, two knees, the chest, the two arms, and the head are touching the ground, and the mind, right? So this makes the difference between the two. So here Prabhupada is saying we talk about dandavats, but we only do panchanga, or don't do anything at all, right? We just do our pranams. Yes, I offered my dandavats to the devotee, means I just, you know, showed pranam mudra and shook it to make sure it looked like something was happening. So then, but here's meaning dandavat means full, how you say, obeisances. So nowadays we'll say full dandavats or dandavats, but actually dandavat means astanga, and anything else that's panchanga or like this. So danda means pole, right? So when you're bent, it's not exactly the pole. So, or nowadays, I guess, interpretation is dandavat means the pole standing up. So it is a pole, right? But it's not exactly. Okay. So here, so what fall down means you're starting standing up, you're ending up, you know, fully prostrated. It does not mean that you, you know, like, how you say, without bending or anything, just fall straight over. I've seen devotees doing that, and they felt they were not fully surrendered if they did not do that, and so they would practice, and they'd, you know, bang their head and get hurt, but, you know, very stoically they'd push on that, you know, this is, I have to surrender, you know, this is not. Devotional service isn't difficult like that. Devotional service is something very nice, something very natural. So here it is, what it is you're prostrating, it means the heart is how you say, submitting itself before the personality. So here we're offering obeisance, it means the heart is taking that humble position. So there's a form of that, so we put ourselves in that form. It's not the ritual of, you know, standing up and falling over as if it was a pole that you just let go of and perfectly straight it falls over. That's not the point. Right? The point is to end up like that on the ground. So whatever it takes to get into that position, then you do that. Like that. Right? Because the superior then means then we accept that our position before the superior, like that. So that humility then generates the ability appreciate the instruction or the superiority of the person. There's something superior there, therefore these respects are being offered. So then, does that make sense? Right. So that's because without authority, then nothing works. Krishna doesn't means this idea of everything's just equal or the same. Krishna doesn't work according to that. This idea of everything equal, everybody the same, everything like that, it's not the way the cosmic creation works. It's a figment of people's imagination. It's like, Brahman understanding or Paramatma understanding. They are concepts of the material world, right? There's no concept of Brahman or Paramatma in the spiritual world. Does that make sense? Because you're dealing with Bhagavan, so where will Paramatma and Brahman come into the picture? Right? You're dealing directly with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so there's no need of Paramatma understanding or Brahman understanding. Does that make sense? So it's a concept of the material world. It's not a material concept. It's a spiritual concept, but it's a concept of this world, right? So in the same way, this idea that everything's equal, everything's, you know, like that, the equal opportunity, it's all meant as oneness, not as individuals have the equal opportunity that if they have a nature that could perform that activity, you know, with all, you know, properness and appropriateness, then that opportunity would be there. That's not their definition. You understand? You see the difference? It's just a general broad statement that makes it's intellectually clever. The mind therefore thinks, oh, this is interesting, so it accepts it, but what does that mean? It's all one. Equal, you know, so that means you have a little child. I once saw one kid. He was 3 years old and you'd sit him down to eat. He would not even start eating unless you piled on his plate the amount that a full-grown, you know, serious adult could eat at one time, you know? Even though most adults, you put it on their plate a few times. Still, how much someone could eat, you know, a good eater in one sitting, had to be on his plate before he'd start, right? Then, being a three-year-old, he'd nibble at it and then walk away and leave it, right? But he wouldn't start with that. So that's equal opportunity. He can get as much as an adult can get. But we see, it's a complete waste. It has nothing to do with reality. Or we could do it the other way around. You get Bhima and give him enough for a three-year-old. But that's not equal. Equal means everyone according to their nature, according to their ability, right? That's the point. But now the difference is God works out what is everybody's need and what is everybody's ability. Does that make sense? So that's why Prabhupada calls it spiritual communism. Because God says, because he knows, you know, a dog eats this because God created the food for the dog. You know, trees drink water. Krishna created that. Right? So equality means according to the nature of the individual, not according to the dictation of the state. Does that make sense? Right? Someone needs to eat more, they get more. Someone needs to eat less, they get less. You know, someone needs to do this particular work, then they do that. Someone else does a different kind of work, they do that. Does that make sense? So that's the... I have to get into this. meaning of equality, because it's in the difference that rasa is tasted, right? When Krishna is in the mood of Atmarama, then where does it come into the picture that you are understanding or tasting any rasa, right? You exist, but that's it. You understand? Only when Krishna expands the living entities, then when there's two, then there's rasa. Does that make sense? So these are just elements, symptoms of the impersonalist concept. Everyone's equal, everyone's the same. But if everyone's the same, where's the rasa? Right? It's just like, if someone was perfectly the same as you, what would happen? Nothing. Right? You sit in a room alone, nothing happens. Right? It's one of the things in astrology. Means actually, in checking the charts for astrological compatibility in a marriage, the main one, or the first one, Nadi, which gets 8 points out of 32, you know, one quarter of the decision, is if the houses, I think it is the houses, the zodiac sign of the two, of the couple, is exactly opposite of the other. Right? Because if it's opposite, means the difference then will generate conversation and interaction, because unless there's a difference, there isn't. So if they were the same, then, you know, it's the astrologers explained to be like sitting in the room with yourself. Nothing would happen. Right? So, does that make sense? So this concept that everybody thinks one, everybody's the same and all that, it's not a proper... It is a idea that comes up as a negative to correct a problem where people aren't dealt with properly. But actually, if you look at it, everybody was equally dealt with not properly. So that was equality. Everyone was dealt with badly. So to correct that, then they try to make it everyone will be dealt with nicely. But the problem is it doesn't work because there is a difference. Therefore, the common citizen and the criminal get equal rights. In fact, sometimes just to overemphasize that the criminal's not being, how you say, dealt badly with, they get more rights than the citizen, right? They break into your house. Having broken into your house, then you come to know of them there, so you come out, they get scared, they jump out of the window, and in the process get injured. And then they sue you for scaring them. Right? And then they win. You know? God bless America. Like this. So, this is, you know, treating everyone the same. So it makes, there's no such thing as, there can be no society with this mentality. It just can't. Because the point is there is differences. But the problem comes is if people use their own subjective view of what is these differences. That's why in the Vedic culture you have to know, it's based on what are the differences as God has decided what are these differences. Does that make sense? That is what is there. So that's not worth arguing, because that's the way it's created. It's worth understanding. It means if you don't understand it, then it's not something that's rejected. If you don't understand it, then it's something to be, studied, something to be contemplated, you know, until we do understand. So this concept of authority is there. There is no equality, right, in that way. Krishna is the superior, right? He is masculine, so it makes him his superior. All his creation is therefore junior to him, or like that. So that automatically puts there. Then you're going to have your persons who are, you have the five rasas, and you're going to have the persons that who are the personifications of those rasas in full. Right? Then below them are going to be anybody else who is engaged in that rasa, assisting that one devotee. Right? And all those devotees, of course, are expanding from Srimati Radharani, because she's the complete, she's the Swarup Shakti. So she is all aspects of rasa. So then everybody else in those primary positions will be junior to her, right? Then within that, then there'll be those junior to them in the rasa, then there'll be their assistants. Right? Does that make sense? then within that assistance, then there's a hierarchy of the parampara down to your guru and then yourself. Does that make sense? So it always, this concept of authority is always there, and they use it in the spiritual world. It's not that everything just floats around and, you know, like that. It's just the rainbows are rainbowing and the birds are flying and the chirping and the butterflies are butterflying and, you know, that's it. That's, you know, and everybody skips around through the daisies and all that with their hair flying and everything and holding hands in a circle. No, that's, you know, it means you can do that, but I mean saying that's not what it's all about. It means there is authority. Mother Jashoda is telling people what to do. Rohini is telling them, you know, what to do in the kitchen, cooking for Krishna. They are telling the servants what's going on. You know, so there is organization, right? They are waking up Krishna and telling him it's time to go milk the cows, right? You know, it's like, he's God, I want to sleep in. Oh, okay, cool. You know, no, it's time to get up, you know. So, you know, you're a Vaishya, you have duties to perform, you know. Like that. So he gets up and he goes and milks the cows, right? So, like that. Does that make sense? So there's a higher. So this whole concept then is embodied in offering a dandavats to the superior, right? That whole concept is there. Nowadays, of course, devotees want to minimize that because, of course, no one's really qualified and all that. Of course, if no one's qualified, that makes us also equally as unqualified. So if anybody had any inkling or something of standard, then therefore, since I am totally unqualified, then they're, you know, totally unqualified plus some qualification. So I could offer my obeisances, right? But of course I won't, because, you know, everybody's the same and everybody's equal. Because if everybody's the same, everybody's equal, that means then really I don't have to follow authority. It means then I can continue on being God, the controller and enjoyer. Right? Does that make sense? So it's actually a non-devotional concept where we reduce the respectability of seniors. Right? Does that make sense? That's the whole point. Everybody is trying to perfect their life, so of course, if someone's coming from the spiritual world, then they don't have any imperfections. But we see, even if they don't have any imperfections, still Krishna arranges that there appears to be some. Right? Yudhishthira Maharaj, you know, we're reading in the Bhagavatam, he's manifesting an imperfection. Right? And Arjuna, he doesn't have any imperfection, but he's manifesting one in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? And so because of this, now do we stop respecting them? Right? Of course, we put on their so-called, so that those that would have problem respecting them because of their attachment to the more morality concept rather than the religious concept, then or devotional concept, then at least they'll be involved, they'll be on board. But actually the point is material world means that there's obstacles and problems, right? There will be something that's there. Mother Jashoda is perfect, but she never can understand that her son is not a little child. Even though he's 16 years old, he's out dancing with the gopis and all that, she can't conceive of that. It just doesn't happen. She's his little kid. You could say that's an illusion. So how can we respect someone who's in such illusion? Here's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She's dealing with him like a little kid, you know? You know what I'm saying? So you can always find Shishupal found, you know, 100 faults in Krishna. Krishna's perfect. They found 100 faults. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Depending on how you look at it, it looks like a fault or not. You know what I'm saying? It may be a fault, but the point is, depending upon the perception you use, does that fault have anything to do with you or not? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Everybody has a problem. Someone has a problem with eating, someone with sleeping, someone with mating, someone with defending, right? Everyone has their attachments. So then, that's between them and their superiors and those that assist them and God. Right? It's not your problem. You know what I'm saying? You may be controlled into eating, someone else not. So how does their having problem with eating affect you? or it doesn't. You have your problem. You have your sadhana. Does that make sense? You have your perfection. Does that make sense? Like that. So therefore, we stick to our own activity. There's a Bengali saying, Nijer Chorkai Tel Dao, means oil your own machine, right? It means you can sit there all day and say, oh, that machine's squeaky, this machine's squeaky, but your machine's squeaky. You oil your machine, they'll oil their machine. You know, so their relationship with Godhead and the Acharyas is unique, so that's between them and there. Does that make some sense? Because the point is whether the person's respected or not, at the end of the day, your problems still remain. Believe it or not. Right? Does that make sense? If another person who's having problems is removed from the scene, still you remain, and your problems still remain. It doesn't actually change anything. Like that, right? It means it pleases the moralistic kind of attitude of the living entity. But it actually doesn't solve anything. Does that make sense? Yes, no? Like that. So that's why the authority must always be respected. Right? Right? It's our business to respect authority. It's the authority's business to be respectable. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Because just as, you know what I'm saying, it's not that it's just because it's a relationship, then we can't say that, well, they're not acting in a way that's respectable, therefore I don't respect. Right? In the same way as, oh, they're not respectful, so I don't have to act in a respectable way. You know what I'm saying? You go out on the streets, people don't know who you are, they're not respecting you as a devotee and the best of all human beings. So therefore, then, according to that application, then you can just do whatever you want because they don't respect you, so you don't have to act like a respectable person. Does that make sense? Right? Does that make sense? So, but one could say, no, but it's their position to do first. Yes, then that's okay. You could say that, because then they're in the masculine position, you're in the feminine, because you're dependent upon their example. So then if you're in the feminine position, how do you take the masculine position of then telling them what to do? You know what I'm saying? There must be a consistency. If you're going to say it's reciprocal, it's equal, then therefore if you don't deal with them right, why they should even behave the way you expect them to behave? But if they must in all circumstances behave as they should, though you as a junior may or may not behave properly, but then that means you're in the junior position, then it's not your right to make any comment. You know what I'm saying? There must be a consistency. That's the difficulty with the modern society, because they don't have any standards. Right? It means conservatives have some standards and they're generally consistent in them, though they may not be very broad or deep or accommodating, but you'll generally see their lifestyle is consistent with how they conceive the values. You know that they'll always act the same. Right? But the difficulty comes with the liberal, because he has no standards other than what, you know, which way the wind happens to be blowing today. Then other than that, so there is no actual method to decide or determine what is appropriate or what is not. Does that make sense? So it's actually a more dangerous position. Right? Like that. So, but the concept of being liberal and all that, that's nice. That's a Vedic concept. Right? But in the Vedic concept, this liberality doesn't mean liberal left. It means broad-minded middle. You understand? There's conservative right, liberal left. Both of them are technically wrong, because even though they both are comprised of proper elements, they're only dealing with part of the elements, or they're taking the approved element but interpreting it, trying to apply it to all time, place, and circumstance when it doesn't. You know what I'm saying? Means you're liberal where you should be liberal, but you're not liberal where you shouldn't be. right? So in other words, the conservatives are correct when they do make distinction between situations and are nice and, you know, and are not, and are very strict in certain situations. That's correct. And the liberals are correct in being broad-minded in situations that would deserve being, you know, giving somebody some, you know, benefit of the doubt. But the point is knowing when to apply that, that is given in the rules by God. Both the principles are correct, but unless you understand when to apply them, you will be wrong. You know what I'm saying? Like you see, just before any revolution, that's the time when the government decided to be very conservative and hold the hard line. And that was what pushed the people over the edge. You know? So they didn't distinguish between these people are actually for no reason just making trouble, political trouble, or these people actually have a problem and they need help. Right? Does that make sense? So therefore the conservative side then made it fall apart. Or, you know, so that's very obvious. The other is that the liberality was such that it was spread to all sections of society, and because of that, then the lower elements then rise up, and then the whole social structure falls apart. And then you see that the society just kind of dwindles away, right? You know what I'm saying? You know, like the Romans, they just dwindled away because of the liberality. You know what I'm saying? So we can see either of them will destroy the culture. If you're liberal when you shouldn't be, and you're conservative when you shouldn't be, it will destroy the culture. But you're liberal when you should be, conservative when you should be, then the culture will be maintained. So that ability to be liberal when you should be and conservative when you should be, then that is called broad-minded. You understand? Like that. That's the point. Because you have your values, you are conservative in your value system, but you are able to accommodate people who are outside of that and help them come to the standard. Does that make sense? Right? That's broad-minded. That's why you see Prabhupada could live, how you say, in any situation. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada's living there with the Bowery bums. Right? Does that make sense? So that's liberal. It means he's not, slosh or, you know, whatever it is, you know. He's not someone, but he's able to live amongst them, maintain his dignity. You know, he's coming to his apartment, there's a bum in front of his door, then, you know, he steps over the bum and goes inside his door. He's not out there, you know, then ranting and raving based on moral principles. What is this? You know, I'm a devotee of the Lord, and then these bums are here, you know, drunk in these socks and that, and they're sitting here and, you know, getting in my way and disturbing my... No, not at all. Because the point is what disturbance are they more than you just have to step over them, right? That's it. Does that make sense? Because Prabhupada has no interest or need for alcoholism. Therefore, this guy does, and this is the result. He's laying here in front of your door, poor guy, and so he just walk around. You understand? But if you actually value alcoholism, but you yourself are trying to keep away from it, then what happens? Right? Then, to convince yourself, therefore, you have to make them into the demon. Otherwise, you do the same thing. Right? This is the moralist. Right? So if you add two and two together, then you know who has what problems by who's standing up and yelling and screaming the most about it when it's not appropriate. Like that. We'll stop here at this point, otherwise it gets very dangerous. But, you know, for the, the contemplating individual, then you can add two and two together, and then you understand what is a worthy position to take and what's not. You understand? Does that make sense? Like that. Because otherwise, if you can't see, how do you help? Right? If you stand outside your door ranting and raving about how all these bums and drunks are going to go to hell and this and that, and, you know, fire and brimstone and, you know, like that. The day of reckoning is coming. And how do you help the person? Right? You can only help if you don't have a problem there. Right? If you're drowning, you can't help another person drowning. Right? But if you're not drowning, then you can help the other person. Does that make sense? You know? So, that's the point, is that preacher means he's able to see beyond these things, right? But it's not that they're ignored, right? The liberalist will also either completely condemn or completely ignore, right? You condemn as that, oh, it's against all proper because, you know, this and that, and somehow or another their concept of moral sense is opposed to the conservative's concept of moral sense, because the one it's feeling and the other is coming down in dry, you know, dry tradition, you know, like that, that it's coming down from some authority, and all this is considered bad. So actually, you can look at it, the liberal mentality, in one sense, tends to be demoniac. But because of its liberal nature, then by their own, own stand, then they must accommodate you. They may like you or not, but they must accommodate you by their own philosophy. So in that way, then it makes it easier for devotees. It's easier in a liberal society like it was interesting, like I saw in one country, the glasnost or whatever it is, and then they were liberated from the centralized rule, and they became independent countries, then their previous church then naturally came up again to power. And so then the church then would be very much against us, right? And the liberal government would be very much in favor of us, right? But the liberals, you know, they support abortion. We don't. We're like the local religion that doesn't. But they'll support us because of other elements. You know what I'm saying? You know, freedom of religion and this and that. And, you know, nice people. We distribute prasad and we sing in the streets. And so like that. You know what I'm saying? So each one can appreciate something about Krishna consciousness. Therefore, they can take it up. Right? The conservative can see there's a nice, the standards of rule. There's authority. It's coming down from God. You know, it's a very well thought out, structured system, you know, with proper, you know, values, social and family values and individual, you know, so it's very good. They can appreciate that. Well, the other can see is that, you know, the broad-mindedness and everything like that and appreciate it. Does that make sense? So each has its good, so therefore it's there. But what we're talking about here is for the individual within the society applying Krishna consciousness into their own life, then if they understand the broad-mindedness, they're in the middle. That's why I said the razor's edge. The razor's edge is in the middle. It's not on the right or left. Right? It means you take the middle as the standard, and then from there, looking forward, you say, this is right, this is left. Isn't it? So if you say there's right and left, indicates that there is a middle that must be the standard by which you judge what is right or left. But that's not, it's strangely always avoided, right? Otherwise, you would say, we're the standard, and then there's the other people, right? The others, or something, you know, why would they always be leftist, always right, unless there is a middle? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the position, is that middle, that broad-mindedness means I have my standards and I am fixed in my standards. Then anybody else who doesn't have standards or not fixed in those standards, then we can help them find a bearing. You know what I'm saying? And it doesn't matter where you start, that point is the place to start from. Does that make sense? You don't have to go back. You start from where you are right now. You know what I'm saying? Someone was in a good position before. They're not manifesting that position now. So to become Krishna, you know, they become situated again, they don't have to go back to where they were. Right? No, they start from where they are now and go forward. Does that make sense? It's foolishness to have to go back or redo or throw it out. Right? It means you have something that's working. And let's say it's working 75%, but there's 25% wrong. Yes, obvious it's wrong. So what is better? Throw the whole thing out, start from zero again, and then try to, you know, in your first attempt, get 100% correct. Right? No. Or is it start with the 75%, now focus on the 25% that's wrong and try to correct that. Then you have 75 good plus now 25 good. Right? So that's Bhaktivinoda Thakur's opinion. Is that you start from what's now. To throw everything out or start over again, that's for idiots. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, then that management in which something is wrong, so you throw the whole thing out and start all over again, how are you going to guarantee you're going to get 100%? Because your problem is with the 25%. You don't have any problem with the 75%. You have a problem with the 25%. So therefore, if you throw out the 75%, what are you going to replace it with? Right? Because it's already working. You know, unless you have an alternative, but unfortunately, there's not necessarily good alternatives to God's system. Right? So the point is they've applied God's system nicely, 75%, 25% they haven't. Therefore, correct that, then you have 100% of God's standards. But otherwise, if you're going to speculate and make it up, then you have a problem, because unless you're as smart as God, then how are you going to make a system that accommodates everything in the system, right? God's system, social system, incorporates the needs of 8,400,000 species of life. All right, that will be applied in the earthly region, the lower regions, the heavenly regions, right? On the mountains, on the plains, in the oceans, in the rivers, you know, in the sky, on the land, in the water, right? In the 10 directions, right? All the zodiac signs, all the nakshatras, you know, the constellations, all the times of the day or night, all the seasons, the Uttarayana, Dakshinayana, you know, when the sun's going north or when it's going south, right? At all ages, at all, considering all elements of beauty, wealth, knowledge, fame, renunciation, and influence. That's God's system. So, it would be arrogance that someone could conceive that they could, I mean, even contemplate that they could make up a system better than that. You know what I'm saying? So, that's the thing, is that conservatives are supposedly arrogant and feel themselves better, but the liberals are equally as arrogant because they think they can think up something better than what has been thought up by, you know, the previous great personalities. Does that make sense? So that's a problem. But that's why modern liberality is actually, it's nice, but it's actually a very, very weak position, because there's no standards to judge anything by. How do you know how to be liberal and kind? You're supposed to be kind and liberal and accommodating and equal-minded, but how do you know what is the standard for it? Right? I'm being equal. Okay, the dog and the cat get the same food. You know what I'm saying? You know? No, it's you have to according to the individual. So that is the point, is that the standards are set by the male. Right? It means God sets the standard. Within those standards, then there's the variety of what is the applications and need of the female. That's what's attended to. Right? So, you need both. But the position where the two meet, where conservative and liberal meet, is in the middle. Right? Sambandha and Prayojana meet at Abhideya, which is in the middle. Does that make sense? So the whole social system then works like that. So here, in any case, is that one must respect authority. One doesn't respect authority, it doesn't work. That's why it's said, even if the authority is wrong, they're still respected, because it's a position. Right? It doesn't mean that one blindly follows or follows their bad example. No, that's not there. But the position itself is respectable. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? People are conditioned. Everybody has a bad day. Right? Because this concept where you don't accept, it's actually... How do you say? Yeah, it's a position where we're not accepting God's standards, really. And what we're basing it on is just our feelings, right? We're accepting that God is important, but it's our feelings towards God that's important, right? So in one sense, you could say, yes, Raghunuga Bhakti is the spontaneous, you know, display of affection of the soul towards God. And so the rules aren't the important thing. But the interesting point that is missed out generally is that Raghunuga Bhakti means spontaneously showing that affection through the rules. Right? Point is without a form, how do you display it? Does that make sense? It means you have to have a form. Otherwise, how do you express it? Right? So, someone comes to your house, you're hospitable. So how do you show that? There must be a form. You know, you offer them a seat, you give them something to eat or drink, or you speak nicely, you sit there with them, you know. You could be saying, I've seen, you know, it's not hospitality is, you know, they're sitting there, you know, on the couch, you know, eating something, and when you walk in the door, it says, yeah, hi, come in, you know, like that, there's something to eat in the fridge, you know, make yourself at home. Okay. So you've offered your facility, but there's no real interaction between you and them. Right? And so for people who are accustomed to not actually knowing what a relationship is, then, yeah, hey, you know, this guy's nice, you know, like that. They're liberal, right? You know what I'm saying? But there's no actual standards of interaction. Does that make sense? Right? It means they've offered the facility, that's proper. But they themselves don't operate the facility. You know? They let you do it. Okay, so you do it, they do it. So that, you know, so the common element is the common facility, but actually you don't really have a dynamic relationship. Does that make sense? So, and all these things we can see there's a weakness, inherent weakness in the modern liberal concept, in that even though it claims personalness, it's actually impersonal. So what you're doing is you're accommodating that others have a different personality, but you're not actually interacting with them on any platform of substance. Does that make sense? You're only accommodating that they're different than you. But you're not actually interacting with, okay, they're different from you, therefore I as my position and them as their position, what is our relationship? That doesn't even come into the picture. Right? Because if it did, then you wouldn't have all these contradictions. You know, oh, the authority this and authority that, and we're so downtrodden and all that, so therefore we make the decision that, you know, they're out. But how do you do that? You can't use the one and the other. We're downtrodden and all that, so please get it together and consider our needs and all that. That would be the statement. Or, we're the authorities here, and you're a junior to us, and you're not doing your duties well, so therefore we're here to correct you. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, but so they take the worst of both. The weakness of the one, you know, and then the strength of the other without, you know, the actual personal consideration. Does that make sense? So that's improper. Right? So what Prabhupada is teaching us, what the acharyas are teaching us, is broad-mindedness. Broad-mindedness means you have a standard, you follow that standard, you validate that standard, at least you're at least attempting to follow that standard, right? It's your sadhana, it's your determination to follow. And then you can accommodate anybody else, whatever position they're at, and somehow or another connect them to Krishna. Right? Think about this. This is the difference. And let us say, you know, we have the famous story, 22nd Avenue, Prabhupada's sitting there giving class. Devotees are sitting down, right? I don't know if you know 22nd Avenue. It's about half the size of this room in width. Length, it's like this long. You know, maybe a little longer. Like that. And then in this place at the end here, this is where the Vyasa-san is. Right next to that actually is the toilet. It sticks out a bit. You know, it comes out, I don't know, about, 6 feet or something. It just sticks out like this and then goes over. Not so wide. So the person sitting here, the wall for the bathroom's there, so the door is over there. So this, you know, one of these, you know, bums comes in, you know, drunken bums comes in, you know, with his hat on, you know, stuff like that, tipping his hat and everything. One comes careening through the devotees with a roll of toilet paper, right? You know, comes in, goes over, opens the door, sticks the toilet paper inside, like that, you know, tips his hat and then walks out. You know, and so then Prabhupada's very appreciative. Here's this bum. Somehow or another he found a roll of toilet paper. Who knows how? You know, bounced off the back of the truck or he stole it from somewhere. You know, who knows how he got it. And he decided that, you know, these devotees are nice. I'd like to do something for them, you know. So he brings his toilet paper and gives it to the devotees, right? Does that make sense? So Prabhupada was very appreciative. This man has come and done some service, right? Does that make sense? Now, you consider, let us say, if Prabhupada wasn't there, and it was just the devotees, and this bum comes careening into the temple, what would happen? Hey, you're drunk, get out of here, this, that. No, no, give this toilet paper. We don't use toilet paper. Get out of here. That is probably a pretty good, you know, speculation of what might happen. So that's the difference between being conservative and being broad-minded. Right? The point is he's giving a gift. Right? He wants to give something to Krishna. Does that make sense? And in his position, he's doing the best he can. You know, at least he was standing up when he came in. He wasn't crawling in or something. Even if he crawled, at least he's making the attempt, right? Like that. Does that make sense? That's the difference between like conservative and this, you know. Is that right? So that's, any questions on this? No? Yes.
How do we know where we're situated in terms of being conservative or liberal?
How do we know? It means you can only really judge if you accept the standards that are there. Because the point is one is, let us just make it, just make some just very broad general like category of, let's say, conservative would mean standards, and liberal would mean accommodating. You know, like that. Because that's something that you could apply to their whole philosophy, right? Not that there's no accommodation within the conservative position, not that there's no standards within the other, but the general principle on which they're working is accommodating and, you know, standards or tradition. So, only if you accept both can then you understand where you stand, right? Because the actual Vaishnava position is a combination of both, but it's the appropriate combination. You know, knowing where you don't adjust your standards and knowing when you do, or knowing when you accommodate, when you don't. Right? Does that make any sense? So if you accept that it is a good standard, but I'm not up to that, or it's a good standard, but others aren't up to that, but that's, you know, they have their particular. And so in other words, it's like this. I have my standards, and so I compare them to what are Krishna's standards, right? What's given by the acharyas. Then seeing that, then I see how much we're in line with that. But I'm able to see. So then we know that that's right, so we make that endeavor. So some things will move quickly, some will move slowly. Right? That's why we have a society. Because everybody will be focusing on a different aspect of their development. Right? And so that way everybody has something to offer to everybody else. Does that make sense? Like that. So where your strength is, that's where someone else's weakness is. So therefore, that's where you can help them. And where your weakness is, that's where their strength is, that's where they can help you. So everybody, that's why society is important. When you're on your own, even though technically you can chant, do everything right, but the point is because you are yourself, you're going to focus on certain things, which is fine, but there may be places that are weak that you don't notice because of the nature of your conditioning. You don't see the importance of them, even though they might be important. Does that make sense? That's why we always stay in the association of devotees. Right? Because then we pick up their good character, good qualities of that, and we can compare. Does that make sense? We don't stay in the association of devotees to find fault. Right? That's not our business. Right? You know, so then, oops, if that is there, then we can accommodate that. Where we stand, right, as far as standards. And then accommodation, how much we're able to accommodate those who, their whatever standards that they follow or whatever is easy for them, that's different from ours, that we're able to accept that. You know what I'm saying? Then that makes you that much broad-minded. Like that. Then you can see where it is. But the point is, wherever it is, it doesn't matter. That's the point. Mode of ignorance is not a factor in this determination. Right? Meaning that if I find maybe my standard or my position is not as good as I would like to think I am in, then it doesn't matter, because now you know where you are, so now you know what to work with. Does that make sense? So lamentation does not factor in. Because we're dealing with what's happening right now. So that's the present. That's the mode of goodness. So therefore, we deal with it in the mode of goodness that, okay, now what to do? And move forward. But if we think, oh, I'm so this, I'm so that, I'm so many things, but then that means we're doing nothing. Right? Someone might ask, no, but in the prayers of the acharyas and Dainya Bodhika, you know, then the devotee is seeing his weakness. Yes, but he's seeing what is the weakness and then now what to do about it. His lamentation is, I'm in this position, therefore it keeps me far away from you, but they're trying to make that connection with Krishna. They're not saying, oh, I'm so fallen, I'm so this and that, you know, I can't do it, therefore why try? Does that make sense? That's not progressive. That's not progressive. Does that make sense? So the point is a Brahmin never how you say? He uses his past against himself. Understand? You learn from the past, but you don't use it against yourself, because otherwise you use it against yourself, all you do is generate ignorance, because past comes from ignorance. Right? It's in the position of a category of categorized in the position of ignorance. Right? Right? Future is passion, past is ignorance, present is goodness. So if we dwell in the past, that's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying, don't dwell in the past or in the future. Right? Don't dwell in the past that's dead, because it's gone. You can't do anything about it. Or in the future that's, you know, how you say, like a dream. But dwell in the present. Right? So he was... Bhaktivinoda Thakur was professing be here now way before, you know, the 60s came along, right? Because that's the position. The mode of goodness is then how you move forward. So, therefore, we look at the past, see what was wrong, but we're doing that in relationship to how to apply it in the present. Right? We're not going into the past so that we get a taste out of the mode of ignorance and then can feel bad and, oh yes, I'm the most fallen, so everybody should, you know, pay attention to me because I'm the worst one here, so I deserve all the attention. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's a matter of, okay, we've done that, we've made mistakes, we know what we should do, now do that and move forward. Right? And we do our best, and if we fall over, we get up again. Right? It means, which child would learn how to walk? Right? The kid that stands up, falls on their face, and then lays there and cries that, oh, I'm so useless, I can't walk, or the one that gets up and does it again, and then bounces off the wall, then falls over, and then, like that, you understand? Kids learn to walk because they deal with just the present. You know, they get an idea to, you know, harebrained idea to walk. They stand up, right? And then they fall over. And then they think, okay, I'm on the ground. So since I want to stand up, so now what do I do to get from lying face down, you know, to standing up? The next time they bounce off and fall on their back. So then they think, okay, now I'm on my back. What do I have to do to stand up? You understand? That's why kids learn how to walk. Because they simply deal with what the present is and what I have to do at present to get myself to the position I want to get to. They don't deal with, I'm in this position. So what? You're in that. Of course you're in that position. Right? You go into the kitchen. Could you imagine this? Here's the cook going into the kitchen to cook Chilraj Bhog offering. They walk into the kitchen and then they look around and then they see some dirty pots and they see, you know, unwashed vegetables. You know, like that, and, dirty counter, and then they, oh no, it's so, you can't cook on a dirty counter, and the pots are dirty, what can we do? And the potatoes are unwashed and unpeeled, and that we can't offer to Krishna, so there's nothing I can do here, there's nothing to offer to Krishna. No, you say, something's really wrong with this person, right, you know? Like that, it's a matter you go in there, okay, pots are dirty, wash the pots, counter's dirty, wipe it down, potatoes are dirty, wash them, peel them, cut them. Then cook. Right? Does that make sense? So that's dealing with the present. That's mode of goodness. Right? So when, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, being in the mode of goodness. Being in the mode of goodness means being present now. Right? You may have a lifestyle that reflects that. But the point is, just because you're eating sattvic food and dressing in a certain way and doing all the things that it says there, but if you're not doing that with the mentality in the present, you're still not in the mode of goodness. Right? Your lifestyle may be in the mode of goodness. You know, your dress may be in the mode of goodness. Your talk may be in the mode of goodness, but you're not in the mode of goodness. Does that make sense? Right? How would that work? Example, a cow. Right? Cow is considered in the mode of goodness. Right? The body functions according to the mode of goodness. Right? They sleep very little. They're always generally active, you know. You're either eating grass or chewing on grass, right? You know, they're doing something, right? So they're always producing milk, right? Cows produce milk and that's produced from grass. So they're always either ingesting grass or chewing on what they've already ingested, right? So they're always active producing milk, right? Isn't it? Like that. But is the soul in the mode of goodness that's in the cow's body? Is there consciousness? No, they're in the mode of ignorance. That's why they're a cow instead of a human. That makes sense? So you could be following all the things of the mode of goodness, but still be in the goodness, but still be in ignorance or passion in your consciousness. So the point is how you know goodness is going on is because you're dealing with it right now, what's happening right now. So that means every action is bound by a mode of nature. You know what I'm saying? So even though Arjuna is on the battlefield, the Kurukshetra, you know, battle of fighting is passion because you're trying to accomplish something. Right? So that becomes very prominent. But at the same time as the methods used are of destruction. That's the mode of ignorance. Right? But it's categorized generally as passion. Right? But the point is you're only successful in it if you deal in the present. Right? You have to deal right now what's happening right now. So still, they're following the position of being in the mode of goodness, though they're applying it into an activity of passion or ignorance. Does that make sense? So in other words, if it's maintaining something, it's goodness. If it's creating something, it's passion. And if it's destroying something, it's ignorance. Right? Does that make sense? So, yeah. Does that make sense? But even if you take even one of that, let's say I'm maintaining, okay, the wall by painting it, still I must get some sandpaper and destroy to some degree the previous paint. You know what I'm saying? And I'm there painting it with the ideas that then it will be nicely painted. So there's some passion because there's a creative element there. Right? But in general, because it's maintenance, then it's categorized as goodness. But I'm only going to be successful at it if I'm in the present when I do it. Does that make sense? If I'm not in the present, then nothing happens. Right? Sandpaper has to go on the wall, or the paintbrush has to go into the bucket of paint and then go onto the wall. Right? Does that make sense? So therefore, the whole point of this discussion is that when you do analyze what the position you're in, don't worry about the past. Worry about where you're at right now, because now you want to get it together. So it doesn't matter what you've done before. You know what I'm saying? That's the point. Because just because something has been done doesn't mean it can't be corrected. That's what human life is for. You know, you could say, oh, you know, I did this or I did that. That's small. What did you do before you came to human life? Right? It means you have been in so many animal forms, so many hells. What did you do to get yourself there? Now that's serious. You know what I'm saying? So what did you do now? You know what I'm saying? So if we want to take all that into consideration, then you go back is that, you know, the real consideration is all that is that, you know, you ignored God. That's how you got yourself here. Right? And we're here thinking we are God. So you can't get worse than that. But unfortunately nowadays, philosophical deviation is not considered very serious at all. But, you know, how you say, moral deviation is considered the all in all, right? That. Unfortunately, it's the exact opposite of how our acharyas approach the subject. Because we keep ourselves in the material. You can be very good, but if you are not properly established in the philosophy, you will not get back to Godhead. You will not get back to Godhead by being good. You get back to Godhead by being Krishna conscious. Right? And so therefore, as a Krishna conscious person, you use the best possible material facility for expressing that devotion to Krishna. And the best possible facility is piety. Right? It means it's the good elements of the material creation that we engage in Krishna's service. Right? It means if we have a stack of potatoes, you always choose the best potatoes to offer to Krishna. You could say it's mundane. Yes, it is mundane, because that's what we're dealing with. So we use the best of it. So therefore, religiousness, you know, proper morality, justice, and all these things, the proper engagement of the senses, the proper understanding of liberation, you know, these are all engaged in Krishna's service. So we take the best of them. But it doesn't mean that just because we've used the best that it's perfect, right? Isn't it? Right? When it comes down to Ritra, Sura, and Indra, who are we considering the best devotee? Right? The demon. Right? Pallad Maharaj is in the demon family. You know what I'm saying? Bali Maharaj, demon. Why do you think these stories are there? Ajamil. Right? Because it's trying to, as it mentions in the second verse, break our attachment to mundane morality. Spiritual morality is important, but mundane is limited. Does that make sense? Just as we're trying to break our attachment to mundane sense gratification, we're also trying to break it to mundane morality and mundane spirituality and mundane, you know, transcendence. Right? Mundane transcendence is this Paramatma or Brahman realization. Right? Like that. Mundane sense gratification, where the senses aren't engaged in Krishna's service. Morality is morality for morality's sake, not what's connected to Krishna or not. Right? Religious means that, how do you say? That we decide what is nature and not how God decides. And even if we know what the nature is, we're not connecting that to Krishna. Does that make sense? You know, like somebody is, okay, I'm a Brahmin, so therefore I do all the Brahmin activities and I do them perfectly. But if you didn't do them for Krishna, what's the use? Right? So therefore you have, you know, the mundane, you know, religionists. That's what Prabhupada mentions, religionists, when he mentions the list. It means someone who's following religion but not connecting it to God. So he mentions moralists, religionists, the scientists, you know, the so-called transcendentalists. There's all things to be rejected. Does that make sense? Right? So everything has its place, but it has its place according to Krishna's standards and in connection to Krishna. So if it doesn't actually connect to Krishna and make things work better, it doesn't actually work at all. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Oh, okay.
Is other than the Sanctum rooms in Kali Yuga, is there anything which will definitely work?
Is there anything that will definitely work other than the Sankirtan movement? No. I mean, here we're taking work means we'll take you back to Godhead. You know, if work means generate money or something else, then, you know, you can get other things that kind of work, but...
Is it left up to the devotees to decide what is best for society in
Kali Yuga? Well, its point is that devotees deciding what is best, it's already decided what is best. It's just a matter of us applying it. We have to figure out what is the best application of what's already decided is best. Because it's already decided that chanting Hare Krishna is the best. So that's there. But you see, all other, let's say, Vaishnava sampradayas, they do that. They worship Vishnu and they chant the holy name. Like that. Though they may emphasize a little bit more on the Pancharatra or on the Varnashram on the Vedic than we may. But it's not that it doesn't work. But their purpose is to get to Vaikuntha, while ours is to get to Goloka. So the proportion changes like that. And especially if you're trying to get to Vrindavan, to Braj, then it adjusts a little bit more. You know? But it's still... The same principles are there. You're still worshipping the deity. You're still following the culture, right? Krishna is a Vaishya, right? Madhu Mangal is a Brahmin, right? Vasudeva and Devaki are Kshatriyas, right? Like that. So it's still, they follow Varnashram and Vrindavan, right? But that's not the impetus for their service like it is in Dwarka. The following of Varnashram is the impetus, you know, the rules and all that. That is the medium. There, it's the spontaneous love that's being shown, though it's shown in the form of Varnashram. Does that make sense? But if some of the elements of Varnashram aren't followed, nobody really cares, because the point is the expression of the love. Because it is so pure, therefore if the form isn't followed, you know, whatever it follows, it still works. You know, it's just like Bahulasva and his wife were feeding banana peels to Krishna. But the point is they were using banana peels. You know what I'm saying? Someone more formal would have used the banana. Right? But them being, you know, more ecstatic, use the banana peel. But they didn't use nothing, right? There must be a medium. But the point is it's still based on the principles. The banana is what is offered, but because of ecstasy, they offered the banana peel, so it's appreciated. You know what I'm saying? So it's still compared to the social standard, right? But because of its purity, then it's seen as nice, you know? You know what I'm saying? The kid takes a crayon and draws some, you know, not necessarily overly artistic drawing on the piece of paper, and then with a big grin takes it and gives it to the mother, you know, and the mother then takes those and puts them away in a drawer somewhere, right? She keeps them. You could probably go now and, you know, you, and your mother still has your drawings from, you know, kindergarten or first grade. You know, it's a good chance, right? So it's that purity or that affection that is appreciated, right? So therefore that's there, but some of them, they prefer showing that through the rules because it gives a form and everything and the dignity and all that that comes with it, and all those things are nice. But in Braj it goes beyond that. Just the expression is more important, even if it seemingly makes one vulnerable, right? Or it was unsophisticated or undeveloped or, you know, not very expert. But because everybody there is only interested in that pure, unalloyed love for Krishna, therefore no one notices any seeming fault in the application of the Varnashram rules. No one cares. Like that. While in Dwarka, then that would be noted. You know, it might be appreciated, like you can see, because they are devotees and because they are pure. Therefore, those that are from outside, therefore the activities of the residents of Vrindavan are appreciated by them. But they themselves can't do it. But they're able to appreciate. Therefore, we see Bhishmadeva on the bed of arrows is appreciating the gopis. Right? So you can't get more, you know, Varnashram than that, you know. Bhishmadev and, you know, his perfection and his vow and, you know, doing everything just correct and right, you know, to the rule, but all for Krishna. But he ultimately, they can see, is that love of the gopis is even beyond what they're, because they're not willing to do something wrong. He's not willing. Krishna wants this battle and he wants the Pandavas to win, so he could just say, hey, stuff this Duryodhana, I'm fighting for a Yudhishthir. You know what I'm saying? But they don't. You know? So, because that is the method of how they serve, right? That's their medium. So medium must be there. So the other than that spontaneity, the rules are used, but it's loosely put together. So if it's favorable, they'll follow it. When it's not favorable, they don't follow it. But then that following of it is still in comparison to the following of it, right? Still, they're still following. Like that. If you know the system and know how it, you know, it goes into itself, you know what I'm saying? Then they're always following. Like that. The principles of culture are always being followed. But the difference will be, you know, the form of it. Does this make any sense? If they're only attracted by that, it doesn't really matter, because attraction is there at some point. At some point, it's like this: the Sankirtan pastime. Why is that going on, right? Advaitacharya is there. He's Mahavishnu. He's the source of all incarnations, right? So that basically means, other than when Swayam Krishna comes, right? Like that, the Swayam forms. They're all him. So that basically means all establishing of religion, all you know, maintaining and nurturing the devotees, all the activities that go on to attract the living entity is all him. Right? He's saying I can't do anything in Kali Yuga. Because all of that's based on that masculine rule of as you approach, he reciprocates that. Right? Because masculine means it's the whole picture. But depending upon which aspect of the picture they're being approached from, that's what you deal with. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Krishna is rasa. Okay? So if Mother Jashoda approaches him, he deals as a son. If the cowherd boys approach him, he deals as a friend. The gopis approach him, he deals as a lover. You know what I'm saying? But the field of the five rasas is his field, because rasa, he is rasa. Raso vaisaha, he is rasa. Right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? It doesn't. Okay, a man has his house, he has his car, he has his money, he has all his furniture and facilities in the house, he has his energy, you know, he has his time. All that he has. Now, depending upon the family, what they want to interact with him on, let's say they want to go for a drive in the car, so then he interacts by going for a drive in the car. Because he also has a house, but when they want to not go out, they just want to be in the house. So, you know, we always go out, we're never together. Then he interacts by being together in the house. You know, oh, let's go shopping, we want to buy this and that, so then they're interacting over his money. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So the point is he has all that. He is the field. That's the meaning of the masculine. But depending on the feminine, how they want to interact within that field, that's how he interacts with them. Does that make sense? So Mahavishnu, he's there willing to interact with any living entity, how they approach him. But in Kali Yuga, nobody cares about God, so they don't approach. So how he'll reciprocate? Right? Does that make sense? So now you only get out of the material world if you approach Vishnu. Right? Even Shiva can't get you out. Right? You can have Brahman understanding and realization. You can be freed from false ego in that you could understand the platform of Brahman. But actual real liberation is going to the spiritual world, because being Brahman situated actually isn't liberation. We call it liberation because in that you're freed from the material entanglement, but it's not. It's temporary, so therefore technically it's not actual liberation. Situate yourself in relationship with the Lord, that's liberation. Right? And even if the mundane thing, that's still approved by the Lord and the potency of the Lord. So, you know, if it comes through Lord Shiva or however, then, but it's still his potency. Does that make sense? Someone wants money, so it may be that, you know, Kuvera blesses him with the money, but still it's Krishna's potency of money that he's been blessed with, and Krishna's approval that the person could get blessed. Does that make sense? Okay. So the whole point comes down to that reciprocation. Right? So now, that means you need the masculine element, you know, for it to work. But nobody's approaching. So how does it work? Does that make sense? So that means it's only the devotee. The devotee does not make that statement. Only as you approach me, I reciprocate. Right? Krishna's made that. So therefore, the devotees can go in and go up to people who have no inclination or interest or idea of interacting with God or approaching God and get them to approach. Like giving a donation, taking a book, hearing the holy name, taking some prasad, like that, hearing the philosophy, you know what I'm saying? So the devotees go out there, and that's what Prabhupada said, that's why it's called causeless mercy. There's no cause for it. You don't deserve it other than you're an eternal servant of Krishna. But otherwise, what you're doing now in karma and jnana, you don't deserve it. Right? But the devotees make your fortune. Right? That's what Prabhupada says, I've made your fortune, now you make others. Right? Because he made it. You didn't have it. He made it. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the devotees. Is that understood? So that means then Lord Chaitanya is, and so because you need the Lord, you need the masculine to free you, but if no one's reciprocating, it's only the feminine can go in and deal with feminine. You know what I'm saying? Because the masculine can only deal if he's approached. If you don't approach, he can't deal. The feminine can approach feminine with no barriers. know what I'm saying? Because there's no rules there, right? Male, female, there's so many rules. With male, male, female, female, there's no rules, really. Very minimal. So therefore, you can just walk right in and just, you know, high ball, you know, like that. Does that make sense? Right? So that means then Krishna has taken the feminine mentality. So here you have Krishna, the one who gives liberation, in the mentality of the devotee. That way then they can preach. So this Sankirtan movement is only happening because it's Radharani. You understand? So the Sankirtan movement is the manifestation of Mahabhava. So-called Raganugis can go eat their heart out. You know what I'm saying? Those who take Sankirtan movements external, they can go shut it. They don't know what they're talking about. They're not even really Raganuga Bhaktis. If they don't accept that the Sankirtan movement has come from Radharani, and therefore it may be the external form of Radharani's compassion and Mahabhav, then they can't really claim to be Raganugas. Like that. Strong statement, but I'm taking the risk of saying it because it's true. They're so Raganuga, like look at this. This is Raganuga. They're so Raganuga that all they think about is Radha and Krishna. So that's nice. A boy interacts with a girl, that's nice, that's romantic. But could you imagine that the boy is so impressed by the love of the girl that he absorbs himself in her mood to the point that he takes on her bodily complexion and her activities? That's romantic. You know, you can't beat that. That's our Sankirtan movement. Right? So now, the point is if you focus on, the reason for saying all this is, you focus on Lord Chaitanya only, there's not really an attraction, or not necessarily a lack of attraction, but just there's more attraction to Lord Chaitanya's pastimes and the Sankirtan movement, so you don't necessarily put much attention into Radha and Krishna. But the point is eventually it gets to the point where you understand that there's that boy, Krishna, who has taken Radharani's mood, so therefore then that will open the door to the Radha Krishna pastimes. Understand? So if you start with one, you get the other. That's why it said, if you're a devotee of Radha Krishna but not Lord Chaitanya, it's demoniac, or a devotee of Lord Chaitanya not Radha Krishna, it's demoniac. But point is if it's done according to the acharyas, one will lead to the other. So one doesn't have to worry. Does that make sense? Like that. So I wouldn't worry about it. You focus there because that is attraction to Krishna, and that's the perfection of life, is to be attractive. Then that will naturally broaden and mature and deepen with time. Does that make sense? Like that. And yeah. And just on the point is that the Sankirtan movement means, as we said, rasa can only be expressed through an external form. Like that. So this idea that you throw aside the external form or it has no importance is not actually a very well thought out platform. It's not a very strong platform. It's not a platform on which you could base pure unalloyed devotional service. Because there is a form, right? Right. We're sitting here going Raganuga and you know, no form, but then why is there Astakaliya Leela? Why is it we can categorize the Leela into 8 times of the day? And it's fixed. Right? Why is it that Krishna always views the Lord Yashoda as a son and never as a friend or as something else? You know what I'm saying? So form is important. So when Lord Chaitanya, means the principle applies to all throughout, when Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy, you know, what's the ultimate goal? And then he's mentioning, using Varnashram, you know, to perform one's duties to please God, right? Lord Chaitanya didn't say wrong answer. He said that's external. That's the external form through which you are expressing that. But what is it that you're actually expressing? Right? So then he kept going up until he got to Srimati Radharani's, you know, platform of her devotion to Krishna. Right? But as you see, Lord Chaitanya was still a very strict sannyasi. Ramananda Roy was still a very strict, you know, governor, or technically a shudra. And they never broke those rules or acted outside of that. But what he's talking about is not the form. Form they're already doing. Here you have two persons perfectly following Varnashram. So therefore, naturally, then bottom of the line is starting with that. Right? They don't even consider below Varnashram being engaged in the Lord's service. It didn't even, the conversation didn't even start there. He didn't say, well, not even bothering with any rule and social regulation and just, you know, somehow or another speculatively just trying to connect your life to Krishna. He didn't start with that. He started with Varnashram being properly performed to please the Lord. Right? Because other sampradayas do take that as a main platform, because when you go to Vaikuntha, they follow Varnashram, so therefore they follow it here. You know, they do here what you practice doing here, what you'll do there. So for them, Varnashram is an integral part of the devotional process. But we see Rupa Goswami doesn't take it as seriously, though we see Rupa Goswami and everybody followed it perfectly. You know what I'm saying? Even though they're beyond it, they would interact with everybody else according to their position within it. You know what I'm saying? So like that, it's a very interesting thing that going on. So the form of the Sankirtan movement, therefore, is very important. It may be the external reason why Lord Chaitanya came, but it's a reason. Right? Oh, it's external, we throw it out. Okay, very nice. Are you liberated? I mean, factually, are you on the Brahma-Buddha platform? I mean, not saying you, but this is, you know, just argument's sake. Are you on the Brahman, actually situated where you're not dealing in any way, shape, or form with your conditioned nature? You're fully freed from that. Right? And if your answer is yes, then we have nothing more to say. But if your answer is no, you are still affected by your conditioned nature, then everything that you deal with is external. You know, except for the holy name, the Bhagavatam, the deities, the association of devotees and living in the Dham. But other than that, everything you deal with is external. Your body is external, your mind, your intelligence, your sentiments, your senses, everything that you are functioning with, any facility you have, any situation you're in, it's material. It's mundane. It is external. So, therefore, if you're going to reject the external elements of Sankirtan or Varnashram, then why don't you, following the same position, reject everything else about your externalness? But that's not done. No, that's what the modern thing is bringing attention to the externalness. Oh, the individual and care for the individual and all this individual. But at the same time as then the Vedic concept of externalness, that's rejected. Oh, we can't do that. Oh, that's fanatic. Oh, that doesn't apply now. Oh, everything's very different. Not, the only thing that's different about today and 5,000 years ago is the mentality. That's it. There's no difference. Right? Eating, sleeping, mating, defending goes on exactly the same way it did 5,000 years ago. Right? Does that make sense? Eat. You pick things up, put things in your mouth. Krishna picked things up, put things in his mouth. So did Yudhishthir. So did Duryodhana. Right? It wasn't that then they just looked at it and meditated and something like that, or, you know, like that. You know what I'm saying? The only ones that don't follow this are babies, right? You know, so I don't know, they smear it all over their body somehow. It gets absorbed through the pores or something, you know, like that. Sucked up from the navel or something. I don't know. They got some different process, you know, like that. So, you know, but other than them, then, you know what I'm saying? So the form, you only have external. But the point is if you focus on the external and take that as the all in all, therefore that's the mistake. Because the mood behind it is actually what it's for, because the external is to express the mood. That's why you don't make a difference. There's no difference between Krishna's inside and outside. It's a manifestation of that. And in devotional service, the inside and outside also is the same. Right? Because the one is the manifestation of the other. Does that make sense? Like that. Right? Does that make sense? So, therefore, the external is important. So it'll be, you know, attached to the Sankirtan movement and its form and all that, and the mood of it, that's fine. Because from there, it will, if it's understood that that is the medium through which that devotion of the acharyas and that and the devotees to Krishna is expressed, then that's fine. Does that make sense? Yeah, so one doesn't have to worry that. But at the same time, as if others are, means, yeah, and Sankirtan movement includes everything. So then, most likely, possibly what's being meant is within the Sankirtan movement, there's a particular aspect that one is attached to. But that doesn't matter either, because that's one of the aspects or one of the forms of the complete form. And as you know, everything coming from Krishna is complete and perfect, therefore, you know, Sankirtan movement is complete and perfect. That means everything within it is complete and perfect. So if there's an attachment to one particular aspect, then that's fine, because that will itself give one all perfection. Does that make sense? Because with time you'll be aware of everything else also, but in a proportion that works for you. You know what I'm saying? Because there's a complete creation, each living entity has a different, slightly different perspective on it. Right? That's why they're, that's the, you know, the natural generation of living entities, is that there's no two living entities the same. Why, if you're dealing in eternality, why would you have two that are the same? Right? Because the experience of one is eternal. So therefore, to create the variety, or have, you know, eternal variety, unlimited variety, right? You know, unlimited in time, then you call it eternal. Unlimited in variety, you know, then is another aspect of it. Therefore, all the souls are different. Right? Does that make sense? So everybody will have their different perspective on it anyway. That's broad-minded. Right? Narrow-minded means, well, unless they're exactly like me, then it's not there. But one naturally, within the unlimited, there's still groupings, right? You know, the gopis stay together, and within the gopis, then, you know, then those who are, you know, the left wing stay together, and of those, then those who are within Radharani's group stay together. You know what I'm saying? So, like that, you'll always have these groupings. That's the, so that's why I said you associate with like-minded devotees, right? So then it becomes nice. But still, there's uniqueness within that. Right? So don't worry. Okay? Okay. So how are we doing on time? Say again?
If you want to commission out the Buddhist in Christian services,
okay, yeah, we can do it, because then we can meet again at, how do you say, 2:30, and Prabhupada Prabhu has mentioned we have till 7 o'clock, so that's pretty good. No, it's 2:30, 3:34. 4.5 hours, not bad. Like that. I think once in Ireland we did 7 hours with devotees on teaching, Gurukul and all that, and 7. Okay, so then we'll end here. Jai. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki.
Jai.
Sankirtan Lila ki.
Jai.
Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki.
Jai.
Sri Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Jai Nitai Gaura Premanani.
Jai.